Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Welcome to Michael Kester's Theater of Cruelty. My name is Eric 13, and I'm joined today with the man himself, Michael Kester.
I'm really proud of this double feature.
What's the show called?
Like,
double feature.
So much
fun. That's it. This is, I'm just going to call it now, best double feature of all time. It's just really, we got two movies. Let's do this proper. Got two movies on the show today. What are the two movies?
On double feature today, we're covering Force Majeure, a Swedish film, and The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which I'm not sure what country claims this movie. There's a lot of places that could claim this one, but it doesn't really matter when you watch it. That's not the question you'll be asking, I promise. It doesn't have that, what did he call it? It doesn't have that 1-inch barrier of subtitles.
Oh, yes. The one. Yeah. I heard that was a mistranslation. Did you hear that?
I don't care.
Okay. We don't. Are we going to context? Don't say things without context. This is what we've learned. After a decade, we now need to provide context. You're talking about the parasite acceptance speech.
Correct. For Bong Joon-ho's, what was that? Was that screenwriting? Directing.
Yeah. Well, I should not talk because all I did is read some fucking headline and not the actual article. But I saw something saying that his translator may have punched that statement up a little bit as she was giving the translation, which I think is funnier.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever, it's fine.
So fine. Fuck that. Fuck crediting Bong Joon-ho. Find out his translator's name and I'll just credit the quote to her.
Great.
Give a fuck. I don't care who said it. We always get bogged down with who said shit. Like, who the fuck cares? I don't care if, like, Abraham Lincoln was like, bitches ain't shit but hoes and tricks. Like, my point is,
God. I'm dying.
I want you to know that bitches ain't shit but hoes and tricks regardless. Fuck all the everything, all quotes,
fuck
Creative Commons, that's attribution. Don't fucking give a shit.
Michael knows he has a little runway to hang himself with, to mix the metaphor today, because we have come up with such a good double feature.
That's right.
Before we talk about it, it's patreon.com/double feature. And look, I just think it's we should, in this journey through the seventh layer of hell, we should take a moment now and then when something good happens to just call it out. So show turned out pretty good today. Schedule turned out pretty good.
Yeah.
I want to thank Ross for asking us to do The Killing of a Sacred Deer. He went on patreon.com/double feature. He put in some money. We put this movie he wanted to see on the show, and we paired it with something. And, you know, we just try to do an extra better job when somebody else asks us to do it than when you or I ask the other, why haven't we come up with any movies for next week? You know, we just do a little bit better maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So look, don't get spoiled on this. See these two movies. We're going to talk about what happens in them. And I'm going to tell you, man, what happens in them is pretty fucking crazy. One of these movies will contain an unprompted drone strike. That's how crazy this is today.
Yes.
We have two tension-filled films about survival in family dynamics in two really different genres. One of these is sort of it's an impulsive barrel of the gun decision that is at the heart of the movie.
Wow, yeah, use the phrase barrel of the gun.
I mean, I don't know how you describe this other than, well, we'll fuck around until we land on a phrase we like, because that is, if that's not the job of Force Majeure, though, that'll definitely be part of the job of Killing of a Sacred Deer, which I think is a film at the other extreme end of the spectrum.
Yeah, it's on another planet, for sure.
If one of these is about impulse and the fallout, the other is like the most extreme end of premeditation.
Yes.
It's nothing if not trying to make a decision about that. Mm-hmm. Fucking. So just totally different ends of the spectrum. It's two movies that hold each other up and I think just make already very, very dense films, just very theme and metaphor rich films. It sort of doubles up the amount of stuff that each one is talking about on yep. its own. Yorgos movies also have this quality of getting more normal in my head as there is distance put between when I saw it.
Sure.
And, you know, I saw The Killing of a Sacred Deer when it came out. I loved it. I thought it was super fucking weird. And with each day that passed, I sort of thought, yeah, that movie might have read a little strange when I saw it, but it's fine. And if I had not rewatched it for the show, as I advise people do, I would have missed out on how still fucking strange it is.
Yeah.
It's as if watching it the first time did not help at all. It is an insane experience.
Mm-hmm.
We should start with Force Majeure, right?
Yeah, I think so.
This revolves around this one incident. Maybe we should talk about the incidents.
So first. The incident that this film revolves around is compounded by the way that they shot it. Everything about this one scene, the people who made this film knew that this was the crux of the film. The color on this in this shot is great. The proportion of restaurant balcony to amount of snowy mountain painting, in the frame. I mean, it's
the Mona Lisa.
It's incredible.
Yeah. The second we arrive in the scene, I'm like, shit, here it is.
Yeah,
we've landed. Right. This is it.
Yeah.
I think I literally said aloud to myself, we've landed the second I saw it. It's crazy.
So putting all that aside until you've seen it, it's just incredible to watch. It's a single shot. There's no cuts. The camera does not move. It's a family of four and a group of other people who may or may not even matter in their own lives by the context of this film.
Yeah.
It's a family of four eating outdoors at a ski resort. At a ski resort that has regular controlled avalanches.
Guys, watch this movie. Don't spoil yourself. What I feel like you are winding up to is one of the, there's just a handful of these in cinema, man.
Uh-huh.
That just images that are burned on the back of my eyelids, you know,
mm-hmm.
just moments I will never forget that there is something, they really are magic. Because what plays out in the scene has a kind of, it has this woe factor to it
mm-hmm.
that you can't help but feel like in your fucking chest as it's happening. You know, when we were trying to pair up stuff on the show, you'd throw this movie at me every once in a while. I didn't know the name of the movie, but I had seen the scene on the internet. And the response when somebody posted this was crazy because nobody, of course, had seen it. The film has subtitles. Nobody knew it existed. And one-inch barrier, too large to surmount, you know. And everybody was just thinking, it's just, look, there's so many movies in the history of mankind. And you could pull out random scenes from these movies and they might be fun, get a laugh, look interesting. But rarely do you come across one and go, the fuck is this movie?
Yeah.
What is that? How have I not seen? I've never seen this.
Mm-hmm.
This looks like it's a modern film. It came out today. How do I not know what this is from? What Avengers movie did I miss that has this giant fucking scene? So I found out about the movie and you were always, thank you, very vague in kind of throwing this movie at me and going, let's pair this with whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of thought I knew which movie this was, but I didn't say anything because I didn't want to confirm that. And then, of course, the second it starts happening, I'm like,
mm-hmm.
oh, fuck, we're here.
Yeah.
What's great about this scene, too, is the crux of the story is it's supposed to create a fight or flight kind of response.
Sure.
And that ends up being what everything in this story hangs on.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most inciting incident of any inciting incident because everything in the story is just sort of fallout from this one split second moment. And what better could you do if your job as a filmmaker is to create this moment that make everybody in the audience feel like they have to run out of the cinema because they're about to be avalanched? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I get watching this scene, I have the same reaction the characters have allowed,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of like, oh, is this, oh, that's interesting. Wow, that's really, do they know what they're, oh my God, I'm going to die. And I feel it in my soul. And I don't know how it creates that magic.
Yeah.
Like, what are they doing here Look, I don't want to make the whole thing about this minute, but I am just so fucking impressed by it. It's just like, how do you capture this essence? What is it?
I mean, I think a big part of it is the static camera.
Sure.
The fact that you know that you're positioned here, that it's not cutting around, there's no motion, you feel like you're static and watching.
Yeah.
And then to see an entire group of people go through the same mental path that you do, it really, what it ends up doing is putting you right in the mindset of what becomes the split decision, mm-hmm. which is you go, all right, here's your family, here's your iPhone.
Well, when you put it like
and
that.
And he's sitting there going, I've got all of Tangerine on this phone. This is my big break.
Right.
So this avalanche comes down. Dad grabs a parent. You don't see him grab his gloves, but he grabs his gloves and his phone. And I mean, crawls over another stranger to get to safety. And the mother, in an attempt to save her children by herself, gets caught in the snowy avalanche, mm-hmm. potentially to her demise. That, of course, probably much to the father's dismay, doesn't happen, and her children dismay. Do survive.
It's kind of funny too, right? Because it's like this horrendous thing happens in a movie, and in hindsight, as we talk about it, you keep winding up to this moment, and I keep going, yeah, it would have been such a relief for these characters if only that avalanche would have just murdered them all. That would have just made exactly. this whole story sure. so much easier.
Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he comes back and everyone's alive, so conflict ensues. Like, that's how it
feels.
Yeah,
exactly.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, and then the story just unfolds in such a good way. I mean, the immediate issue, it's just that level of denial that the father adopts, where he goes, I remember it differently. Mm-hmm. And it seems it's just a thing that I really identify with, which is just pretend that the problem isn't there.
Well, the fact that you felt the need to spell out what happened in that moment is already kind of curious to me, right? Because we're trying yeah. to kind of like mentally set the record straight on what we saw. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, he just flat out denies that that's how it went down.
Right.
And so what starts as sort of a husband and wife laughing at each other's different interpretations of the events sort of spirals out of control into just the worst dramatic conflict. Mm-hmm. You know, what starts as kind of a comedy premise, just by the time the movie's over, is just gut-wrenching in its kind of sadomasochistic levels of exercising the drama
right.
of what happens there.
Sure.
And it's just tiny aggressions. It's kind of a slow burn of that conflict.
Well, yeah, I mean, it calls to mind the fight or flight response, which isn't it's not the exact term. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the translator, you know, punched it up a little, but
now I'm wondering about all movies with subtitles.
Right?
Inherent totally blew over the meat of that.
Yeah.
Of the poetry of that sentiment, which is that subtitles are a translation of what the movie's saying. So if yeah. the translator is talking about the subtitles and punches it up, it sort of pulls the rug out from under what you're...
Yeah.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
So they talk a lot about fight or flight response, which is... it's interesting. One of the things that this movie calls to mind, and I want to just at least mention it early so we can sort of track it down throughout the course of the conversation. It brings up this idea of the knee-jerk reaction, fight or flight, whether you're in the small percentage that's a hero or the larger, greater percentage that's going to try and protect yourself just out of the naturalistic animosity that is being the human animal. It calls into question this potential reality of, are you ready? Mm-hmm. The duality of man.
Oh no, the duality of man.
it brings up this idea toward the end when the father is having an incredibly difficult to watch cry on the floor. Although, I mean, if you can have the moral and physical high ground to just smoke and watch it, maybe it's easier to watch. I don't know. But he says, you know, he's speaking about the man that materialized,
mm-hmm.
which is to say that there is sort of a, to get Freudian, there is an id inside of him that does these things that he doesn't necessarily even condone in his right mind.
Yeah, yeah.
However, that force is there inside of him. And it basically goes, do you have to accept that as a part of a human, or is that their true self?
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, I think the movie does a lot of things throughout the rest of the film to, I mean, if I'm being really honest, walk back from that conversation. Has the wife get off the bus without the kids?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And like that is definitely from a narrative standpoint meant to sort of even the playing field maybe. But I think what that's really doing is she goes, well, shit, if like that's his natural reaction, who am I now? Who am I with? Who are these kids' father? And it's tough to look at this movie that just keeps throwing fight or flight responses at the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And go, which person is really sitting in that chair? Is it the guy who defends himself from the drone? Well, you know, that's a character, I think, too, that they intentionally throw in the film, but he is the hero, right? He is naturally that moral 5%.
Yeah.
But then I already mentioned the moral high ground, but the film fucking throws that at you all the time, too.
Well, it's amazing that that little drone moment cuts the tension in these scenes.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, absolutely. But it's terrifying. But it's shot like a horror movie.
It didn't even like occur to me that immediately he throws his hands up to protect himself.
Yeah.
It's not that he throws himself on top of his wife or his mm-hmm. girlfriend to make sure she's okay. He throws his hands up. I suppose every second of the film could be fucking analyzed on like, mm-hmm. was your momentary decision altruistic enough? This does again, yeah, you made a joke about Tangerine, but man, it does feel like we are again talking about the Priscilla Queen of the Desert.
Sure.
Sort of like, are you missing the forest for the trees
mm-hmm.
sort of thing here? You know, everybody just had this, I don't know, like, look, here's why this is such a tough movie for me. This movie talks about family values. It talks about masculinity, sort of the role of a man in a family unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about instinct. And it just makes me feel like I am in so much trouble because I'm like hitting one for three of those,
mm-hmm.
if even that. You know, like, I just don't, the concept, first of all, the concept of, you know, a man's role in a family unit, it causes me sort of a instantaneous vomit feeling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like the people in the theater when this movie played, they all vomited and fainted, know what I mean?
Yeah, I remember that.
It's a little bit like that. But also the family values thing, like is just another term that I sort of associate with kind of being gross, kind of another terrible thing in society. Family values is the mask by which people banned albums from Walmarts when I was younger, you know?
Sure.
But even beyond that, like, I'm not a family person. I don't have kids. I definitely don't like this construct of a family needing to be a husband and wife and somebody to take this particularly male role.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this stuff is kind of difficult. I wonder if that makes me more sympathetic of him or if it is what the film's doing. You know, when she first starts showing her signs of, the first people you see it from is the kids. They immediately come back.
Sure.
And it's beautifully done because it's just, of course, the kids are like pure emotion. There's no trappings to what they feel. They come back, they feel bad. They don't even know why, really. They're not articulating it. They just feel bad. He and his wife kind of have a laugh about it, you know, sitting in the other room when their kids have told them to fuck off, which is a part of Swedish culture I very much enjoy. But eventually she kind of like has this feeling of, I have been wronged and this is actually terrible what you've done. But over the course of the film, these incidents that come up that are so, it's just like such a beautiful skeleton of a film too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the moment itself, but there are these kind of beats of like, go back to the room, the brutal scene when he pulls his phone out and the whole room watches what actually happened, which just like is so awful. And they do such a good job of beating him up more and more as the film goes on. When he's on minute 25 of his ugly cry and his kids are gripping onto him, wondering why their mother won't address the dying animal on their floor. I don't know. I feel like at that point, it's pretty fucking tough not to feel for him.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Because to the kids, again, just pure feeling, they're going, what are you, a monster? Why do you not see this? Our father is wounded. Do you not? What are you just going to sit there?
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think like there is, I don't know. I guess what I'm asking you is, am I alone on my roller coaster journey here of hating this guy, of having a laugh, then hating this guy, and then thinking.
Well, no, that's the thing, man, is I think sort of that's what I was saying about the other man that materialized is this guy. Imagine that, you know, let's put this in a different perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
You, Eric 13, wake up one morning with your hands covered in blood, only to find surveillance video of you sleepwalking to the front of your property and stabbing a person who walks by. Then you go back to your bed and you fall asleep. And then you wake up in your bed and you're now being accused of something you had no control over yourself doing. I mean, no control.
Yeah.
It is beyond you on one hand have zero deniability that you've done this thing. If anybody is to blame, it's got to be you. However, you yourself also did not decide to do that.
Yeah.
Right, and by the time he's crying on the floor, he's crushed by the weight of the reality that he is now having to answer for a decision he never made.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it feels like it's been taken. Like, I just want to blame somebody in that moment. And I really don't think there's blame to go around.
You can't. It sucks.
The children aren't even articulating anything. They're just feeling what they're feeling. And his wife, I mean, I don't know. Maybe if I thought about this more, I would feel like there was some moment where it was like, okay, you need to ease up now. But really, she's just reacting to her own genuine, very real feelings that she's allowed to have. You know, she felt like somebody in her life deserted her and their children, showed his true colors.
Right.
It just, you know, when you see a film play out an experiment like this, you want so badly to point the finger at someone and go, here's the, because a film is, it's a document. You know, it's documentation of this thing that happened so that we can look at it over and over. And when you play out a moment in your head, when you think about this whole family vacation, you kind of go, man, if I could go back to that and play it over and over, I could find the moment where this all fell apart, where maybe we still could have fixed this, or maybe there was still, maybe someone did. It's like replaying the footage on the phone in that scene to kind of go, where's the fuck up here? Let's analyze the gameplay and make a call. And so to watch this film and not really know where we're going, okay, well, to me, the most brutal, terrible thing that actually happened is as a result of what everyone around him has been saying, this person appears completely decimated, crying on the floor, having one of what you might assume are, you know, the worst moments of his life. And he got there, I suppose you could argue, because of something he thinks he found out about himself. But if he had had the support of his family or the other people around him, then he wouldn't be going through that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the avalanche is a much bigger deal, but that's brought on by a sort of natural, that's nobody's fault, really.
Sure, sure.
Not in this family unit. So now I'm just looking at a person suffering, going, at what point could this have been avoided? Who should have acted different? What should have gone differently? And feeling, you know, a great deal of sympathy as whenever we see somebody suffer in a movie. And it's sort of terrible to keep playing this out. I mean, I think this is the cruelest part of what this movie does, is to keep playing this out and going, you know, in that instant, my honest reaction is, you guys are too hard on him. Look at him. You've reduced him to nothing. But I don't know at what point in the story I should tell somebody to tuck in their feelings, their own valid personal feelings, so that their, you know, their dad or spouse doesn't cry.
I mean, so we could just immediately transfer to a universe with no feelings whatsoever, where everything is just a calculatedly odd, pragmatic look at, honestly, a situation that I think anybody would wish was out of their hands.
It's interesting to me already that you call this another universe, because there's sort of a need when you watch this movie to, again, to point at it, you know?
Sure.
To go, what the... I feel like, all right, so you and me could talk about this here. Let's talk about what's wrong in the world outside of the killing of a sacred deer. Everybody saw this movie. Great. Mm-hmm. Super good. You talk to people about this movie, and I don't know about your life, but in my life, people want to talk about, you know, they know it's Yorgos. That's a little secret they know. So they go, oh, it's a Greek allegory, which I think is just a thing people fucking say because the director's Greek. So they're like, got a little, it's a Greek allegory. And they avoid the elephant in the room. And it makes me insane because they want to talk about the sort of things that we usually address on Double Feature.
Sure.
The thematic elements of it.
Right.
They want to talk about this decision.
Sure.
They want to, and this is kind of the rare time when I want to try for a moment to not talk about the meat of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about how fucking weird this movie is.
I mean,
and then no one will address it like I'm insane.
One of the things, even back with The Lobster, even with Dogtooth, that I think is really a difficult question to answer when you're watching a Yorgos Lanthimos movie, is how many people who ever pass through the frame think Colin Farrell is normal.
Yeah.
You have scenes that take place in the world outside of a room of the five people who have speaking lines.
Mm-hmm.
On the street, in the fucking hospital, you have other human beings. Now, are they going... I mean, he's a really good, he's a good guy, but he talks funny.
Yeah.
Or are they also going, are they speaking with the same cadence? Is it a universe of people who just say exactly what they're thinking?
Yeah, it's tricky because I feel like I have circled around, and when we talked about The Lobster, this was another, you know, sticking point, is I want to be able to describe to someone what it is that makes this movie the way it is. And I think at the time I'd landed on the word stilted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's stilted performances, which I don't think holds up under any scrutiny. I think about it, you know, it's an alternate universe. It is fucking pod people.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way this movie plays out is as if we were watching Nicole Kidman's other movie, The Stepford Wives, you know, or one of these kind of 50s to 70s sci-fi or 80s sci-fi. A lot of these older, let's stick with pod people. That one was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you see a scene in the very beginning of the film where everybody comes out of pods and then the movie plays out the way it does, nothing is really weird to me as an audience member. It's
right.
Doing what I anticipate.
If the opening sequence is just everybody like waking up and getting out of a refrigerator.
Yeah. 100%.
Then you go, okay, cool.
And the fact that, you know, and it's not, it's, the reason I don't like the word stilted is because I also don't think, I don't think it's purely true to say these people are without emotion.
Sure.
Because I do think, like, that's as close as I kind of got. But then I recall scenes where, you know, Colin Farrell's character and the boy's mother are on the couch, you know, and she's like, they, people in this, it's not just stilted. They make eye contact. Mm-hmm. They feel things. The whole story is about this emotionally difficult decision that he doesn't want to mm-hmm. make, right? Mm-hmm. And it's about how tough, like, I think of all of Yorgos's movies, maybe with the exception of The Favorite, like, this is a very emotionally loaded one mm-hmm. in the, just not the fabric, but I guess just like the, in the meat of what it's doing. The story is about an emotionally charged, what would you do if your family was on the line type. Like, you could just see it in the fucking synopsis. And this doesn't sound, and to try to apply this sort of Yorgos vision to this seems like there might be some dichotomy here. That these things are at, would be used to opposite effect. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I have trouble with that too, because I guess let's talk about the actual effect that this has going through this movie. I feel like, and why this makes me crazy, is because by playing, the word you had is cadence, which I think is maybe a good way to talk about this without solving it. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to do here, right? It's like,
sure,
we don't know. We can't fucking figure it out. It's the special sauce. It's the magic moment of the previous film. You know, mm-hmm. if we had it, we'd be Yorgos. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why he is who he is and why people pay attention to these films and why they're all so Yorgos. So by doing this the way he does, the effect that this has on me is that this plays out with this sort of, it's a tension, but it's like a fucking Kafka tension.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. it's like the trial or something. You're just like, why? Hold on. Can we address right. the why?
There's never a why or
no.
how.
No. And it gives.
The why or how are always dropped.
Yeah. And so it's tense and it's horrifying in that way. Like, it's a horror movie. It's my favorite type of horror movie, which is one that doesn't use any trappings, really. Mm-hmm. There's no like, oh, it's a horror movie because there's a ghost. Mm-hmm. There's really only one element that's kind of like supernatural, and the rest of it is just the way that it's done. Mm-hmm. The technique, all of the technique just says, this is fucking horrifying because it is. And I think we see so many of these kind of, I love movie, you know, like Funny Games or something, where it's just, it's horror because, yeah, that situation is fucking horrifying. Mm-hmm. It's not horror because it's part of the slasher subgenre. It's not horror because, although maybe Funny Games is a bad example for some of this, but you know what I mean? It's the sort of horror of everyday existence. So it gives you that element, that feeling. But I think one that services the story more, one is that that's more important to it as a work of art, is that it provides this fucking sense that's clearly working on audiences, that there's a deep feeling of metaphor in the movie that you just feel because of the way it's doing what it's doing. I think by searching constantly and going, why is this movie doing this? I feel like we are seven layers of metaphor buried in every scene. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just something deep under the surface, some sort of allegorical thing that needs to be addressed. And I think the movie knows this because it kind of makes fun of metaphor as it goes along.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The movie is, that's what I was saying at the beginning, is it's not a comedy.
Yeah,
for some reason.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, I mean, pitch black, but it knows that there's some funny business
yeah.
going on. But yeah, I think that, you know, the very first thing I said is that I think the biggest contrast to this film is exactly the antithesis of the problem in the previous film. I think all characters, maybe barring the puppet master boy in this movie, all characters would wish that there could just be some out of their control, knee-jerk, lower brain decision that just does this for them. And then they look back on it and just have the fallout.
they're going, wouldn't it be nice if this was
if an avalanche just killed one of us?
Yeah, right.
Whereas the family in the previous film would have loved to have 2 weeks or however long it is to decide what you're going to do in case of an avalanche.
Uh-huh. Doesn't make life any easier.
Right.
Yeah, it's great that the conflict is the very opposite in that way too.
Yeah.
Right. The very thing you're begging for in one movie is the cause of these are grass is always greener movies.
Mm-hmm.
This is why this is speaking to me so much today, is these movies just going, God, if only it were the other way, things would be so easy. You know what I think is actually kind of interesting about Martin? The whole time that you want more rules to help take you away from the conflict or do the, you know, in so many other movies, I think an audience watches them and kind of goes, here's what I'd do
right
in this situation.
Of course.
Here's the one neat trick that they are overlooking that dismantles this whole conflict. And in a world like this, you just can't fucking do that at all. So then you kind of get aggravated that why aren't you addressing the fact that Martin can just control, just has some sort of,
right,
don't even know what to call it, right? Because anything you call it is wrong.
Right.
He has cast this spell and that's not it at all. And yet that's sort of what it is. And one of the just bits that I love so much from this movie is when they finally come to a moment where Colin's character, he makes some offhanded remark about it. You know, he's got this choice to make, this fucking dire, impossible decision. And when he starts to argue with his wife about it, you know, they're doing everything but making the decision. He's doing everything but making the decision. He's looking for all these sort of loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
Not even the sort of, we'll make it a community decision. Well, they're not doing that fucking circle movie from Netflix you and I always talk about.
Right.
They're not going like, whose life is of the most value and what should we? Some of the characters are doing that.
Sure.
You know, some of the beauty of what the film's doing that we just gloss over is like how everybody, it's the obvious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, put in that circumstance, what's everybody do? Somebody tries to prove their innocence, another person maybe sucks up, another person tries to empirically prove the value of,
mm-hmm,
let's say, her life. Let's say she is Nicole Kidman's character. We could always have another kid. It's kids are replaceable. What you can't make is babies with your children. Think about that. Didn't think about that, did you?
Huh? And there are no other women in this universe. You're a fucking weirdo. You're never going to meet another lady.
It seems like a very strange argument. Yeah, so they do eventually come around to that, but there is kind of this denial phase. I mean, that's exactly what it is, where you're sort of wanting to just, well, you know what I'll do? Didn't think about this, did you? I'll murder you, Martin, and then you won't be able to do this thing. And he goes, you can't ask for more genies.
Mm-hmm.
You can't ask for more wishes. That's not how, stop trying to cheat. So the motion of the film where we're dealing with the, how do I cheat my way out of this? As a person who is so obsessed with the technique of what the fuck is going on here, how is someone doing this feeling to me? How are they making me feel this way? I love that whole section because it ends in this hanging a label on it or not hanging a label on it, where maybe if we could address the very fucking thing that's happening, that's what I want to do the whole time. What's going on here? Why does this person have this magical power? Is this even real? Like, let's sit down and talk about, is this even happening? And I'm just begging for somebody to go, what are you mad? You think this kid is casting a spell on you? And for at least let's have the scene and it'll dispel some of the internal tension of what the fuck. And then we get this moment where Colin and Nicole Kidman, when their characters are arguing, and he says something like, oh, well, what do you just want me to get, like a toe of newt, eye of bat, and then it'll all go away? And they say that, and by invoking witchcraft and then treating it like, well, no, of course, I'm not calling this witchcraft. You're like, well, hold on a fucking second. Like, by somebody going, well, obviously it's not witchcraft. That somehow just makes it so much worse.
Right.
I don't know why, but just that one moment of it goes, well, there's, I guess, deciding that it's witchcraft and then using some sort of mythical rules, I guess that's not going to help us either. It's like you were saying before, if everybody got up and walked out of a refrigerator in the beginning of the film, yeah, of course that's weirder just as a beat in a story, but it does something to help us set context or something
mm-hmm.
to help us go like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they all walked out of the refrigerator. So this is like a weird world.
Yeah.
You know, to do Eraserhead, but it's like set in your backyard and, you know, you work with these people. Like there's just something so surreal about it. And when you're trying to solve a impossible conflict, but also doing it in Yorgos' world, it makes it
right
infuriating in a way. It just makes it so much more tense. I'm sorry, I'm bewildered. I don't even know where I am. I don't know up from down right now. I was just thinking about the scene where everybody's talking about the girl getting her first period.
Yeah.
Which is just like a thing that they're just talking about, like it's totally normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, well, it is totally normal. They should just be able to talk about it, but not like that. Don't talk about it like a Yorgos movie. And you know, you just trip over these things and they become like compounded.
It's bizarre. The reality of the film, the reality of all of his films are just so bizarre. And they're treated in such a way where they're not bizarre, which of course just makes it
better, worse, better.
Same. Worse and better. Is what I look for in anything.
All right.
I want it to be worse and better at the same time.
I'm going to lean against this tree and sing, and you get us out of here. How do you feel about that?
All right. Sounds good. We have a website. That's doublefeature.fm. If you want us to do movies of your choice, we're going to do one, not that you chose, but that somebody chose next week. One of you chose it.
But you could choose the movies, patreon.com/doublefeature, and you could help us out. I need a lot of help right now.
Okay. Well, how about I lead you into who are the executive producers for this episode? Just this episode of Double Feature. I don't need more than that from you.
I think I can do that. It's Abbott of Unreason, Ben Ecker, Brett Hayton, Charles Crawford, Tom Leonard, and as always, John. Thanks, guys, for being executive producers.
Did someone say Charles Crawford? Why, he's the guy who chose next week's film, Blow Up.
Oh, that's good.
And then in an effort to do something drier and more British, we chose Barry Lyndon as a film that goes with Blow Up.
So glad we've already done The Shining, because if I had to spend any more time at Snowden Ski Resort, so I would fucking kill myself.
Yeah, so we're going to look a little bit at photography, look a little bit at painting to a certain degree, but I mean, honestly, the real paintings of Barry Lyndon are, it's Kubrick. It's what you're looking at.
You know, they shot that whole movie on an iPhone.
I heard that. Okay. You know, the role of Alec Baldwin in Barry Lyndon.
Do you know Alec Baldwin shot that whole movie on an iPhone? I'm going to try not to talk about candles at all next week. We'll see how that goes.
Anybody who watched Barry Lyndon in the theater threw up. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.